Health Committee on Human Services on today, February 15th, 2010. Senator Winters, come on up. Oh, open up a public hearing on SCR 21A. Welcome, Senator Williams.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. And I want to thank you for hearing this morning what I think is a wonderful Senate concurrent resolution honoring Dr. Jim Lace. And I believe you have all the information before you, but let me just tell you some of my personal involvement with Dr. Lace beyond the work that he's done here in the Capitol on with healthy children and the children that he takes care of in here in Marion County and in the state. And often we think only of what is being done within our borders of the state of Oregon. But Dr. Lace's practice and the work that he does goes far beyond Oregon. He is doing extensive work in Tanzania, and in fact, he was responsible for getting me involved a couple of years ago with some of his projects. Project that started out when he went to climb Mount Kilimanjaro, and in the course of climbing Mount Kilimanjaro, his tour guide told him about a couple of women who were actually trying to do something about the children who were orphaned because of HIV AIDS. Dr. Lace, and he's this individual that if you talk about children, his heart is immediately there. And so what was the discussion of what can they do has now turned into 30 orphanages in Tanzania. He got me involved. He sells artifacts and crafts here at home, and everyone he meets, he talks about the work that needs to be done there and the number of orphans. So on one of my visits, I had the opportunity to visit three of the centers. One was called Cradle of Love, which is where they take from zero to three, and most of these children are found in the bush. And then another one was called Rafiki, and Rafiki was in a small village, and it was interesting because at that time they had a mud dormitory with no windows, mud floors, and the objective was to try to raise money to build a true center complete with water. And one of the things I had committed to Dr. Lace that I would come back to Oregon and help raise money for water, something very basic that we take for granted, but there it is an absolute necessity. So last year, Dr. Lace and I together raised over about $60,000. Representative Huffman came and joined us in the Wine for Water project. I had the opportunity to go back and visit, and in going back to visit, I visited other sites, but to see the well, to see actually that water is there, that children that I saw before and villages that I saw before was very, very desolated, and you could see not only the hunger and the need, but going back this time to see children saying, welcome, Senator Winters, and we love Senator Winters, and having a tree planted by the well that says Senator Winters, State of Oregon. Dr. Lace is there. And you have to know him to understand that he's still climbing Mount Kilimanjaro. He's climbing Mount Kilimanjaro for children, not only here in Oregon, but around the world. And so I just thought it was very befitting, and when you read the things that he's done, that we here in Oregon should honor. So often we honor individuals who've gone. I think that we need to honor individuals who are still here, still doing their work on behalf of all of children in the world. So those are the reasons that I brought this forward. I can't tell you how great it was to go on a trip with him and to see the work that he's doing. He is working with OHSU to provide an exchange of doctors between our country and their country. In Arusha, with a population of 3 million, there's one pediatrician. For our physicians here and our interns and others, the experience and the ground for learning is phenomenal because they're having to make decisions, you know, very quickly without all of the equipment that we have here. So we're working on that exchange, working with Western Oregon University, working with Students Exchange to go over to help on some of the agriculture projects and some of the other things that Dr. Lace is doing there. So I would just encourage you to pass Senate Concurrent Resolution 21, and if you have any questions, I'd be honored to answer them.
Thank you, Senator. And we have someone else who has signed up, Dr. Peter Bernardo. Could you come on? Senator, why don't you just stay right there while Dr. Bernardo speaks, and maybe we'll see if anyone in the committee has questions. Thank you,
Senator,
for coming.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, good morning. For the record, I'm Peter Bernardo, current president of the Oregon Medical Association and a general surgeon here in Salem. I also come to speak in favor of this resolution and in favor of my friend and colleague, Jim Lace. This is an easy thing to do. I will tell you the testimony I've done here in the legislature over the last few years. This one was caused no angst on my part and was very uncontroversial. I think many of you have seen Dr. Lace wandering these halls in his print shirts and shorts and sandals. That is who he is to a T, very unaffected, very caring. Senator Winters has spoken of his work abroad. I would speak about his work for the children of Oregon. If you look at pediatrician's practice in this state, you all know we have high rates of uninsurance, of poverty, of hunger. Half of all of the patients that Jim Lace sees on a regular basis are Oregon Health Plan patients or uninsured. He's doing his community work every day in his practice. His work overseas in Tanzania is incredible, but he lives that support of children and that lifestyle on a daily basis. And beyond that, in this state, he has worked incredibly hard here in the legislature, working for the Oregon Health Plan, for healthy kids, speaking against obesity, speaking against any number of issues that affect children and affect the state as a whole. He is a gentleman that I respect very much. I met him 25 years ago on the basketball courts up at OHSU. He was a fellow in pediatrics, and I was a medical student. And even when he was blocking my shots on a regular basis, he was the nicest guy. And it's been my pleasure to work with him over the years here in Salem. He has been recognized by his colleagues in medicine and pediatrics for all of the work that he does. And this resolution from the Senator Winters from the state acknowledging his work is wonderful, and I fully support it, as does the Oregon Medical Association and physicians as a whole. And I, too, will be happy to take questions if you have any.
Thank you, Dr. Bernardo. Any questions of either of these witnesses? Thank you so much for coming. And, Senator, thank you for bringing this resolution to us.
Oh, thank you for hearing it.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll close a public hearing on SCR 21A and open up a work session.
Chair Tomei, I move SCR 21 to the floor with a to be adopted recommendation.
Representative Boone moves SCR 21 to the floor with the to be adopted recommendation. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Is okay. Representative. That's all we do?
Yep.
We don't have to pass anything more?
No.
We adopt it. Okay. Let's see. Representative Huffman, do you want to be the carrier?
Certainly.
Great. With that, we will close the work session on SCR 21. Thank you.
I guess I didn't say A.
Oh, sorry.
Madam Chair, before yes. you move. I just want to introduce a couple people.
Oh, please.
If I may.
Sure.
I have my daughter, sitting in the back, Trista.
Trista, you've got to stand up.
And it is her 14th birthday today. You can sit down. And next to her is one of the foreign exchange students that is currently living with us this year, Lena Fritz.
Hi, Fritz.
She is from Germany, and she's been a wonderful addition to our family. And she's in a class called American Government, which is required for seniors. And it's been very interesting because she comes to me and asks me questions that I think people just would know the answer to, but because her perspective is different coming from Germany, it is the double take. There's a double take in answer, you know, and having to explain those answers to her in a way that will make sense. But anyway, both are here today, and hope you can welcome them. Thanks.
Absolutely. Welcome to the legislature and to the Human Services Committee and to the Capitol today. Thank you. Thank you, Representative. I'm glad you brought them. All right, we will open up an informational hearing, an update on Oregon's Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission. Bruce, do you want to come up with Max Williams? And do you want to bring the other folks with you to start out with you two?
You two and two.
Good. Thank you for coming today.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Bruce Goldberg. I'm the director of the Department of Human Services and the Oregon Health Authority. Chair Tomei, members of the committee, we're here today to give you an update on the new Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission. What I wanted to do was just to start off with a brief introduction as to why we're undertaking this. I think all of you know that drugs and alcohol drive up health and human services costs. They weaken our economy and, quite frankly, contribute to the vast majority of criminal justice problems we have in this state. You know, put a different way, drugs and alcohol are significant cost drivers within our system. And while they're cost drivers, they're also a significant issue that destroy lives and families in our state. This is a huge problem. It drives much of what we do in the Department of Human Services. A recent study by Eco Northwest found that substance abuse costs the state almost $5.4 billion a year. It's a huge number. Some of this is in lost productivity, some of it's in crime, some of it's it's prosecution and loss to victims. Some of it is in the healthcare costs. Some of it is in the human costs that substance abuse causes. Over 60% of the kids in our child welfare system are there because their parents have substance abuse problems, and we can only treat about a quarter of those families. And some drugs, methamphetamine in particular, drive nearly all the property and violent crime in our state. Nearly 70%, Max will tell you a little bit more of this, nearly 70% of Oregon's prison population has a substance abuse problem. At the same time, we have huge gaps in our services. The federal government has estimated that about 261,000 people in Oregon are in need of treatment for alcohol and drug problems, and yet we as a state treat only about 64,000. So we treat less than a quarter of those in need. We spend about $200 million on treatment and prevention a year, and that's spent through the Department of Human Services, the Oregon Youth Authority, through the Department of Corrections, and through the Criminal Justice Commission. All have funds that go to treatment and prevention of alcohol and substance abuse. And our system is fragmented. It receives money from various arms of the federal government, from the state general fund, and from other sources, all of which have a variety of requirements. These monies funnel into various agencies and then go out again without significant coordination on our part as a state. We found that one of the biggest issues is treatment gaps for 18 to 25-year-olds. They access health care at lower levels than older people and are less likely to self-refer for treatment and are at a particularly vulnerable stage in their lives. According to the Healthy Teens Survey here in Oregon, almost 30% of eighth graders have had an alcoholic drink in the past 18 months. So almost a third of eighth graders have had alcohol in the past month. The national average is 16%. Teens are increasingly beginning to try prescription drugs as well. I think, as all of you know, not only do we have a problem with alcohol abuse and illegal drugs, but we have a growing problem with prescription drugs. And it really is against this backdrop that we're beginning our work with the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission. This is a significant problem in the state, and if it's one thing we can put our finger on that will help us out into the future, it's this. The commission is charged with putting together a 10-year comprehensive plan on prevention and treatment. This isn't simply about treatment, as you'll hear later. If we can make significant strides at prevention, we can really change things in our state. We'll give the governor a report with our recommendations on May 1st. The report will make recommendations on policy and statutory changes that should be made in our alcohol and drug system. We've got subcommittees looking at the structure of how our system works, a subcommittee looking at treatment, which you'll hear from, and one about prevention and finally accountability. You'll hear in a minute from Max Williams, the director of the Department of Corrections, about structure, from Tim Harnett, who's the executive director of one of our state's alcohol and drug treatment programs, CODA, and president of the State Association of Alcohol and Drug Treatment Providers, and he'll talk about treatment. And finally, you'll hear from Tony Biglin, a professor at the Oregon Research Institute, about prevention. And before I turn things over to Director Williams, just let me make one final comment about accountability. We understand that it's of critical importance to provide accountability for how we spend monies on alcohol and drug treatment and prevention. And while we're ahead of many states, actually Oregon is ahead of many states because we're required by law to adhere to evidence-based practices, something that actually Director Williams helped spearhead when he was on the other side of the dais. We've got a ways to go. The commission is looking at evidence-based practices, assessing the fidelity to those programs, and putting together outcomes. I mean, I think a part of our challenge ahead is how we assure the same kind of accountability, data collection, and adherence to evidence-based practices across the entire system. So I believe that this commission can hopefully provide the governor as well as the legislature with a lot of the recommendations that hopefully you can act on to help move us forward as a state. With that, let me turn things over to Director Williams.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be in front of you this morning to talk about this issue. My name is Max Williams, and I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Corrections, and I serve on the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission. During my time in the legislature, I think one of the things that was the most challenging for me as we tried to address this issue was to consider how fragmented, and that was the word that Dr. Goldberg used, how fragmented the delivery system was around alcohol and drug treatment, not only fragmented through a variety of state agencies, but fragmented in the funding source and in the structure. Dr. Goldberg and I, biennium or so ago, actually funded a report that was done by an organization called HRSI that attempted to track the funding stream. And some of you may have seen that the first graphic in that report, which is a connection of boxes and arrows that sort of looks all over the map like a really bad, like a flow chart that's been stuck in a blender and sort of spun up. And that's part of the challenge, I think, that we have had as a state in effectively addressing the needs of how do you take whatever the limited resource stream is from the federal government and from the general fund, from other funds categories, like the money that comes out of OLCC and potentially flows back in at some level into the system. How do you structure structure that with those limited resources in a way that's going to get us further down the road of achieving the kinds of objectives that Dr. Goldberg talked about, and impacting the state of Oregon in a variety of ways, whether it's the child welfare system, where we pay an incredible amount of money, or my system in corrections, where we're sort of on the receiving end. We're the caboose on the end of the system. We catch the last sort of vestige of the breakdowns in every other place in the process that's ultimately led to people being victimized as a result of crimes committed, driven substantially in our system by people who have severe addiction problems. So the purpose of the commission, as Dr. Goldberg pointed out in part, is to try to achieve these issues around how do we get a better structure for prioritizing those resources, where we need to put the money in the right places across all sorts of streams and across a variety of state and local government budget systems. And then once we've done that, how do we prioritize and make sure the kinds of treatment that are being delivered are the right interventions for the right people in the right place in the system? And then Dr. Goldberg's also mentioned the issues associated with accountability. Part of what the commission is doing now is essentially evaluating a variety of potential structures driven primarily by those principles that I just identified. We are looking for the appropriate structure so the right decision makers can be in a place to help make recommendations about prioritizing budgets as the governor's recommended budget is identified, and prioritizing the delivery of services, identifying the policies and standards that need to be in place to ensure that those things are going to be done in an appropriate, evidence-based and a correct intervention. And then again, the data collection issue, which remains, which is really what you have to do to demonstrate the accountability. And one of the challenges that we all have, and I know that you're familiar with it from your own seat in regularly probably asking challenging questions of all of us and some of our other compatriots in this effort, and we struggle to give you the apples-to-apples kinds of comparisons or results we want because there isn't any consistency in the collection of data across our system. There isn't a unified criminal justice data system, for example, and so we take bits and pieces of data from lots of different systems and attempt to try to get you the best answers we can. But as we move forward in this process, that's going to be an absolutely fundamental and critical part of how we do this, to demonstrate that accountability by actually coming together across all of these silos and developing the appropriate kinds of standards for data collection and accountability. That's the structuring principles that we're working under right now, and we hope as we put this report forward to the governor in May that we will have a recommended plan for how this would be structured in the commission, so those policies and practices and budgets could be reviewed and prioritized so the governor could consider that in the development of his governor's recommended budget. And then obviously this same group would come in and present those same priorities and explain their rationale to the legislature, as you ultimately have the final role of writing the state's budget around these issues. I'll just make a couple of comments, changing hats briefly to be the criminal justice representative on this commission today. Dr. Goldberg mentioned that 70% of our population in the Department of Corrections has an alcohol or drug treatment need, and a vast majority of those, you can relate their criminal activity, the thing that they did, whether it was a person crime or a property crime, in most cases you can relate that activity back to an influence of drugs and alcohol at the time that the act was committed. We prioritize treatment primarily in the Department of Corrections for the last 6 months of their stay, where we believe, based on all the evidence, it will have the best bang for its buck. And we do that by also having to prioritize the people we give it to and those who we believe are most likely to get out and reoffend. We reach just under 50% of the population that has what we would consider to be a high to moderate risk of reoffense and a high need for alcohol and drug treatment. So there are a large number of people that we release out, given our current resources, who have need for these interventions and simply because of our need to prioritize those resources haven't been able to achieve them. But as effective, and we believe it's effective, alcohol and drug treatment delivered in a prison setting is effective. In fact, one fact that this commission has come to educate me on is that residential treatment beds for alcohol and drug treatment are few and far between in the state of Oregon, and approximately 50% of the total available residential treatment beds for alcohol and drug treatment in the state are behind the walls of the prisons in the Oregon Department of Corrections. So half the people that are getting alcohol and drug treatment in a residential setting in the state of Oregon are getting that because they were convicted of a crime, a felony, with a sentence of more than 12 months, and are getting it because they're in prison. That just demonstrates, I think, to some degree, the limited access to the kinds of alcohol and drug treatment interventions that are necessary. But as important as what we do is, even more important is the opportunity for that alcohol and drug treatment to continue when someone releases out, and that they have access to that at a level in the community. And that's another place where I think generally you would get a unanimity of agreement among the participants in this commission, that the resources currently are not prioritized in a way that, that treats this very expensive population. And they're expensive not only for their own needs, but they're expensive because when they do reoffend, if they don't get those proper interventions, they've created a victim of crime. They've created disruption to that victim and their family, and they come right back in the criminal justice system with the expenses associated with local law enforcement, with trial, with public defenders, with district attorney expenses, with the court expenses, back into the Department of Corrections for the expenses then associated with their care during the time that we have them incarcerated, and then back out again in the community with supervision requirements, and the circle just continues. So a small intervention that can break that cycle for this population is absolutely not only the right thing to do from a public safety standpoint, but the right thing to do economically as a state. And those are the kinds of things that we believe that a greater unanimity of purpose among all of these streams of money, all of these silos, as we establish policies and priorities, is going to lead to better outcomes and ultimately to a safer community and the communities that all of you represent and that we're all happy in Oregon to be part of. So with that, I'll just say that I believe that the work of the commission is incredibly important. These aren't easy issues because we're asking people to break down silos that have existed in various state agencies and local governments for a long period of time. And I'm convinced from my own experience of having done this on the other side of the dais on occasion that we will not get 100% unanimity of thought around all this. There will be people who will not like some of the recommendations that this commission ultimately produces, but we'll bring a plan back to the governor, and I assume that that plan will eventually come to you for endorsement. And I ultimately believe that this is the path that is going to allow us to leverage those very limited resources that we do have in the most effective way possible. And I'm proud to be part of this effort and to work with these people who are interested in trying to really substantially change the approach that we've taken for at least the last 20 years around this issue. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
And I know we have one question, but I want to ask a question. I've seen that, of course. I think our committee has seen it, and Ways and Means has seen the spaghetti that goes all over the place. So one of the reasons that we have silos is because the money comes from different sources. How are you going to get that those funds into one place so that it can be sent out wherever it's needed?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I think you've asked one of the most difficult questions that the commission, as we work on this issue of structure, is attempting to deal with. And Dr. Goldberg and I have spent a long time talking about this ourselves. I'm not convinced that you necessarily have to pick up all the money and take it out of each of those individual budgets and put it necessarily in sort of one stream. But what I do think you have to do is you have to make certain determinations about prioritization and about implementations of policies that have to be part of that. So an example might be that this commission would review and make a recommendation that the Department of Corrections appropriation request for alcohol and drug treatment to hit a target audience may be different than it currently is right now. I come in and argue separately in front of Ways and Means for the money that I need. Representative Freeman, who's a member of that committee, knows that process. And I come in and make a separate argument for the amount of money that I think I need from the general fund to support the alcohol and drug treatment efforts of the department. What I would expect is, in the future, that those priorities with us at the table as we work through this would be established. So what I'm asking for would match the prioritization that this group has already come up with, and that has ultimately been endorsed by the governor in his recommended budget. And it may be different, and it may prioritize them differently than what I would have asked for independently before, because I've now sat at the table with Dr. Goldberg and the counties and the Oregon Youth Authority, and we've decided that for all of our efforts, more money in prevention is probably a better investment in this biennium than me coming in and asking for X numbers of millions of dollars to expand something. Now, I'm making that up because it may not be that. They may decide that prioritizing my very expensive population is the right thing, but at least what we'll do is we'll have a unified approach, and I won't be trying to dip into Dr. Goldberg's back pocket, or he won't be trying to dip into my back pocket to fund whatever we think are the priorities. We will have gotten to that beforehand. And I think you can do that without necessarily having to strip out budgets. In the end, particularly for state agencies, because we all report to the governor, and once the governor's recommended budget is the governor's recommended budget, that becomes our marching orders for going in and asking for money from the legislature. So at least within the executive branch of government, you're going to get, I think, a fairly unified approach once this group makes its recommendations and priorities and they become adopted by the governor.
It will take a lot of cooperation and collaboration, won't it?
It will.
But Chair Tomei, I think the other issue is it takes collaboration and cooperation. It also, I think, takes some sort of a formal structure, mm-hmm. and that's what I think we're looking to put together, because you can't solely rely on goodwill.
Right. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What does a drug and alcohol treatment program look like inside the prison? And I'm sure there's not just one answer for that, but if you could kind of give me an idea, are we looking at separate bed and facilities? Are we looking at drugs to bring them down from where they need to be, counseling, all the above?
Chair Tomei and Representative Huffman, typically an intensive alcohol and drug treatment program in a prison environment, there are units that have been designated for that, and they're staffed appropriately with professional alcohol and drug treatment counselors who then deliver the program. Cognitive restructuring-based alcohol and drug treatment program that's a model that's a nationally recognized model, but it does require that they be separated at some level inside the institution. So it runs as a therapeutic community, essentially. The intensity of the program is the thing that ultimately leads to its success. We've learned over the years, and this was one of the experiences I had in sort of getting more familiar, even when I was in the legislature, with the whole issue of evidence-based programs. We spent a lot of money for a lot of years just talking to people about the effects of alcohol and drugs on their system, and what we ended up with was a bunch of really educated addicts. I mean, they could tell you everything the drug was going to do to them when they took it, but it didn't have anything to do with ultimately breaking their cycle of involvement in the process. And so what we've learned is its intensity of the treatment. And as a result, you'll see if you went back and looked at our numbers over the last decade, we probably are treating fewer people, technically, than we were before. But because what we've done is we focused the resources on first prioritizing who we're giving the treatment to, taking the people who we think are the highest risk to recidivate and create a new victim of crime, and then targeting in a very intense way the treatment. So the dosage is much higher, their engagement is higher, they live in a therapeutic community where they're ultimately held accountable. But it does require a certain structure. You can't have 120 people in a therapeutic community because it's too big, it doesn't work. So typically in our system, we try to make these somewhere between 50 to 60 bed units, and we focus those 50 to 60 people that are in there during their period of treatment, have a lot of additional resources surrounding that, because that's frankly what you have to get if you're going to get any benefit of the outcome. Does that help at all?
Yeah, follow-up.
Follow-up.
So it sounds like since you're dealing with smaller wings or units, a lot of the additional costs would be in personnel to oversee, because you've still got to have X number of additionally trained individuals to watch these?
Chair Tomei, Representative Huffman, that is correct. Typically, the Department of Corrections is providing sort of the day-to-day operational security, but in virtually, I think, every one of our treatment programs, we contract out to other organizations that come in and actually provide the alcohol and drug treatment. The delivery of the program itself is done through contractors, and we have several different contractors around the state that we contract with. It's actually one of the issues that Dr. Goldberg and I have been working on even before the commission started, was to move towards unifying. I had a certain approach and was contracting with often the very same providers that he was contracting with outside, but our contract approaches were different. The standards were not necessarily the same. And so we're moving, part of this effort is to move towards some of those back office functions where if you're going to contract with the state of Oregon, regardless of whether it's DHS or DOC, there ought to be, you know, it ought to be the same contract. We ought to be charging for the same price for the same services. I mean, those are the kinds of efforts that we're actually trying to work towards.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Well, I've got several other people, and I'm going to put you on hold and have some other questions answered. And what I'd like to suggest too, that maybe we'll want to visit one of the programs during have a field day. Since it's right in Salem, and we could get firsthand knowledge of what's going on.
Would be more than happy to accommodate the committee, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Doherty.
Of the resources you have, limited that they are, how much is percentage-wise or dollar-wise or whatever is used for prevention programs?
You'd be better at that than me, Dr. Goldberg.
Chair Tomei, Representative Doherty, we spend very little. Less than 10% of what we spend on treatment is spent on prevention, and I can get you the exact figure. I think the issue, as you'll hear in a moment from Tony Biglin, I mean, there's two issues. One, we know that treatment works. We also know that prevention works. And at some point, we have to shift our resources from expensive treatment, particularly expensive treatment in the criminal justice system, to keeping people out of prisons and not using. You know, my example has been, we, as I indicated, 60% of kids who are in our child welfare system are there because their parents have untreated substance abuse. It costs us approximately $16,000 a year per child to have them in foster care in our child welfare system. And if their parents are in prison, that's another $25,000 a year approximately. And if they have two or three children, the costs go up even further. We can very economically treat people for far less money and keep families together and keep lives together. And so the question that we've really got to grapple with is, how can we move? We don't want to have a system where the only way you're going to get treatment is to go to prison.
Of course.
We want to keep most of treatment outside of prison, and we'd like to also focus more on prevention. And I'll get you the numbers on prevention. We spend far too little on prevention, and I think that's one of the issues that the commission and others have to grapple with. At some point, as a state, we have to make some priorities and decide whether or not we want to take a longer view and put additional dollars into prevention, perhaps at the expense of some treatment.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you for asking that question. That's an issue, certainly, that's very important to me, Representative. Mm-hmm. And when I hear about the number of eighth grade children who are using alcohol or drugs in the last month, twice the national average, and that says to me we need to reach people much sooner. And so that's an issue I'll be working on also. Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the interesting things in this discussion of funding is the federal government. I know that in Hood River County, we have a federally funded prevention program. It's been quite active and is nationally recognized. Then in addition, our Mid-Columbia Center for Living, which provides mental health services, has this Systems of Care grant, which is a huge grant. So, you know, listening to what you're saying, I think there's another issue of disconnecting and driving how you do business. But I will support the comments about residential treatment, because we operated in both states, and Washington residents did have residential treatment, and Oregon did not, for the needs that we found in Head Start for our families. So I definitely feel that's a high priority for a lot of our families. And I know that we work very hard on prevention, and our Commission on Children and Families works hard on those issues. So I'm hoping that we can do more about prevention.
Chair Tomei, Representative Van Orman, I co-chair the Prevention Subcommittee, and one of the issues we've been working on for the last 2 months has been simply to quantify the various ways that prevention dollars are come to this state and how they are spent, because they come through schools, local commissions on children and families, through from federal grants, from ourselves as the state, from a variety of places. And I think one of the issues that we're going to need to grapple with is whether or not or how we perhaps take a statewide approach to prevention and coordinate what are a lot of great efforts, but it's the same issue as happens with treatment. We have a variety of programs throughout the state, and the question is, could we get, could we move forward faster if we had a greater emphasis and coordination on how we, A, use what dollars we have, and then, B, how we can enhance some of that.
Thank you.
Representative Maurer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. It seems to me we need to back up just a little bit and talk about the education of the people in this body who don't have a full understanding of everything that you talked about. Because I think most of us come into this, you come in with different experiences, but you don't understand where the medicine is or the science is today about the recovery model and how that is different than even it was viewed 10 or 15 years ago. It's important. I think the best analogy that I heard, and I really appreciate their work, and we went to Seattle together, and it was fabulous to see the cooperation between two state agencies, which we don't always see. But the analogy between the treatment of substance abuse and diabetes and how we look at it societally very differently, but substance abuse is a lifelong problem, and you don't treat it, we talk about residential treatment, you don't just cure it. It is something that lives with them for the rest of their life, and they have to deal with it. And so I think the education of the people in this body, it would be a huge start. And I'm really sad that I was not able to do as much as I wanted to. But I think it is imperative that you start with this group, because, visiting the treatment facilities, talking to us, these people that are going to be skeptical about spending dollars in treatment and what that means is hugely important.
Madam Chair and Representative Maurer, I appreciate you raising that issue, and I believe Mr. Hartnett behind us will chat a bit about this, but the notion that has certainly, I think, shifted in the last decade to an acknowledgement that addiction is, in fact, a chronic disease, and treatment interventions around addiction produce similarly the same kinds of results that you see with treatment interventions around diabetes, and that's often, I think, why that example is used, and we would recognize someone who we would say, hey, if you quit taking your insulin or you get off your diet, we want you to get back on it, because from a health standpoint for you and for the system, it's smarter, and so we keep trying to make people successful. And oftentimes we do think, I think, that someone who's dealing with serious addiction issues, well, if they were in treatment for a while and they were clean for a while and then they failed, they relapsed, so we're going to wash our hands of them, we're going to call the program a failure. failure, we're going to call the intervention a failure, because they relapsed. And I think the acknowledgement just has to be, you know, I set some personal health goals at the beginning of the year about what I was going to eat and how much weight I was planning to lose by the 1st of March. And I have to confess to the committee that I've relapsed a few times in between January and February 15th. But to an honest degree, that is a change in philosophy, and it's certainly been a change that's been something that, from a public safety standpoint, has been a difficult one to swallow, because we sort of all expect they're going to come in, we're going to give them the treatment inoculation, and they're going to be better, and they're never going to relapse, and they're never going to commit another crime, and that's how we're going to evaluate whether we were successful or not. And frankly, that isn't the model that is going to ultimately demonstrate whether we've been successful. And Dr. Goldberg, obviously, is the doctor, knows way more than I do about this issue. But it has been a fundamental shift in thinking, and I appreciate you bringing it up, because it is one that we're going to have to educate not only each other but our colleagues broadly if we're ultimately going to be successful at this effort.
Representative Dembro.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wonder, could you remind us of just who is on the commission? And there's a broad commission, and then a lot of the work is done through subcommittees, as I understand it. So could you just kind of remind us about that, Bruce?
Sure. Chair Tomei, Representative Dembro. The members of the committee are set in statute, and we elected a chair, which is Attorney General Kroger, chairs the committee. There are a number of us from state agencies, so myself and Director Williams and Superintendent Castillo. There are members from the treatment community, members from the courts, sheriff's associations,
district
attorneys, tribal representatives. I can get you a list, but health systems. There's the head of a large health system, insurance companies. The committee is really composed of, and we'll get you a list from the both of the names and in statute. But in essence, what was tried to happen in putting this commission together was really put together what I would say are several different constituencies: state agencies, folks from criminal justice, folks from the treatment community, individuals who are in recovery themselves, tribal representatives, law enforcement, all the stakeholders, and two legislators, Representative Tomei, who is one of them.
Great. Mary Ellen can get that to us.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And can I follow up? You know, in terms of the relationship with coordination with the counties and the local entities, which are obviously critical here, how does that work in turn? And this is to you, Director Williams. How does this work in our criminal justice system? And you talked about the focus on treatment in the last 6 months for inmates who are high risk, at least. Which sounds, and that makes a tremendous amount of sense, and I think focusing, I assume, on their support for them during the parole, you know, phase of their being in the system. How does that work with the counties? I mean, are the counties also doing something similar? Is that kind of uneven? Are you trying to coordinate that together? That seems like it would be a great idea if we're not doing it.
Madam Chair and Representative Dembro, I think the answer would be yes to all of the above. There is a great effort at coordination. The way it works for people who are directly releasing back to the communities from prison, which is, if you think about everybody that a county parole and probation office supervises, they supervise, obviously, people who have released from prison. They also supervise a large number of people who are under probation who never went to prison. prison. They got convicted of a crime, but the crime required that they be supervised on a probation level offense, and oftentimes they're also high risk at need for alcohol and drug treatment intervention. So the counties, given their resources, decide how they're going to use both their own money, and then we have community corrections money that is funded through the state. That community corrections money then is really at the county's control to determine to a great degree how they're going to utilize that money, whether they're going to fund jail beds or whether they're going to buy treatment beds, both for mental health, alcohol and drug, the amount of money they're going to spend on supervision. Typically, that plan is put together at a county level through a broad cross-section of stakeholders, something called the Local Public Safety Coordinating Council that operates in every one of those counties, and they put their plan forward. And it varies county by county based on those priorities. But there is a growing effort, particularly through the Governor's Reentry Council, again, something that Dr. Goldberg and I work pretty closely on, to try to ensure that we're handing people off to the counties and prioritizing those people, again, who should get the first shot at access to the availability of treatment slots. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that if you've been in residential treatment in prison, you need to drop right back out and do residential treatment in the county. More often than not, it's something less than a residential treatment. It's more of a day treatment sort of an approach that might continue for the majority of those people. But the handoff and the consistency in the delivery of some sort of ongoing alcohol and drug treatment, the ability to move people into the kinds of housing environments, for example, where there is a strong no drugs, no alcohol sort of policy to, again, sustain them, particularly during that first period of time when they're going to be out on their own and have access and availability to the very problems that got them into this place to a great degree in the first place. All of that is something that we attempt to coordinate. But that coordination could be better. On the commission itself, we're fortunate to have Chair Ted Wheeler from Multnomah County serving on the commission and chairing one of the subcommittees. And he's been, particularly because it's about 25% of, at least from a public safety standpoint, where our business comes from and where it returns to, and they have a fairly large and robust program. He's been a great asset to the commission. But you've hit again on one of the big challenges. We do things in a very fragmented way. We've always believed in local control, and so you get a very different flavor of these kinds of problems based on whatever county you're going back to. And they're not particularly uniform.
Mm-hmm. Can I just follow up one last question?
I'm going to get to Representative Frederick first, and then I'll get back to you.
Actually, I'm continuing this to some of what you talked about, Representative Dembrell. Thank you very much, Chair. My concern, in addition to some of the things you've already talked about, is something that I heard in talking with folks from the Cascadia group several months ago. And it was that they find themselves dealing with an incredible amount of administrative overhead because they have 8 or 9 different programs that may affect a single client. And as a result, they're spending the time filling out the appropriate forms, and they get the money, but the money's coming from different sources, and because it's coming from different sources, they're not getting a chance to use the money wisely. Because they have to be spending the time on paperwork. It just as a concern of mine, I'd like to find some way to not necessarily have all the money come from one source. That's going to be difficult. But if possible, consolidate that work dealing with individual clients.
Chair Tomei and Representative Frederick, that's one of the issues we've begun to work on already and hopefully will be a focus of the commission, because you're exactly right. I mean, part of the issue is it's not simply that dollars come from a variety of places. It's that we have a variety of different contracting, administration, and data standards that come along with that. That creates undue administration for the state, undue administration for the providers, and quite frankly, creates a huge amount of waste that we could put back into service. And so one of the issues that we really have to address is, Max and I have talked about this a lot, we need to be able to have, we're contracting with many of the same counties, many of the same providers, yet we do that in a variety of different ways, and we need to be able to put this together in a simple, common, and very lean administrative structure costs. We're not going at, I hope we have the dollars that we need to get the work done. And we're going to keep trying to do that. But shame on us if we don't use the dollars we have as efficiently and effectively. And I can tell you both from the perspective at the state agency as well as having been a provider and talking with providers out in the community, we have some work to do in helping to streamline some of the administrative functions. And it's a critical aspect of what we need to do.
Colleagues, I know there are more questions. I'm concerned. We have floor session at 10:30. Can people stay? We have two more presenters, and I want to make sure that we have time to hear from them.
Madam Chair, Republicans are caucusing at 10.
Oh, okay. So I know there are more questions. Could you ask these questions offline, please? Representative Huffman, too? Great. And so we can move on to our other presenters and make sure that we're finished.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair.
And we will be asking you to come back again later, certainly after your presentation to the governor. So you have a little bit over a half hour. I'm sorry to squeeze you into a short time period, but that's where we are today.
Chairman Tomei and representative and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Anthony Biglin. I'm a senior scientist at Oregon Research Institute. I'm the former president of the Society for Prevention Research and the director of the Center on Early Adolescence. I'm also a member of a Lane County committee that's chaired by Dave Frohnmeyer and Gene Tate that is working on the problems of public safety in Lane County. And as a result of that, I become sort of much more intimately aware of the important relationship between human services and public safety. We've treated those too often as two separate things, but I think it's better to see the relationships among them. This is data from the Oregon Healthy Teens Survey showing the rates of different kinds of problems among adolescents in 8th and 11th grade. I've circled the alcohol use in the past 30 days. I should mention, by the way, that what I've handed out is a monograph that our Center on Early Adolescence produced. Representative Maurer mentioned that it's important to educate people about these things, and I think that's very important, and that was one of the reasons that we produced this and are prepared to go out and help people understand the importance of human development for crime prevention and human well-being. I led a group at the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences in 2001 that studied youth with multiple problem behaviors. And what you find is that these problems co-occur, all of the ones that I just showed you. And for example, among eighth graders, behaviors such as substance use, antisocial behavior, sexual behavior, and depression are more than four times more likely if you have one of those that you have others. These problems are interrelated, and it's the same kids to a great extent who have all of these different problems. These problems are also quite costly. This is an analysis we did of the cost nationally of these different problems. The total, as you can see, is over $400 billion, and that was in 1998 money. I took the population of Oregon to just estimate what the cost is for Oregon, and it's about $5 billion a year, the cost of kids with these problems. And these multiple problem kids with multiple problems are especially costly. 20% of the youth who have multiple problems account for 70 to 80% of the costs of drunk driving, violent arrests, total arrests, drug health problems, alcohol health problems, improper needle use. If we can focus on these kids and prevent the development of these problems, we can prevent a lot of problems and save a lot of costs. One thing to know about these problems is that they develop over time. Aggressive social behavior among kids, young children, is actually one of the most important things to be focused on. Kids with aggressive social behavior tend to be uncooperative. They get to school and they don't learn as well. They get rejected by their peers, and that puts them on a trajectory toward significant problems later in life. So they have academic difficulties, problems with peers, and by early adolescence they've drifted toward other troubled peers, and they begin to experiment with problem behaviors. This is well established in the research that's been done in the last 20 years. And the earlier these problems begin, by the way, the more chronic and serious they become throughout adolescence. The Institute of Medicine is part of the National Academies of Sciences. It's chartered by the federal government to provide reviews of the science relevant to just about any problem. And the Institute of Medicine focuses on issues of human well-being. I was on a committee that produced a report published last March on preventing mental and emotional and behavioral disorders. That summarized the work that's been done in the last 15 years, and I can tell you that there's been an enormous amount of progress in terms of what we know. And the reason is that there have been an explosion of randomized trials. These are the number of randomized trials in recent years, where the randomized trial, you randomize folks to either get or not get an intervention, and if they're different at the end of the intervention, you can be pretty sure it was because of the intervention, because otherwise they're equal. And so it's thanks to these randomized trials that we know so much about what works to prevent problems. The IOM report said that basically it's now possible to pretty much assure ourselves that virtually every kid can arrive at adulthood with the skills, interests, and health habits they need to be successful and caring adults. And this is a table, a chart that kind of summarizes all of the things that we know about preventing problems from prior to conception right through young adulthood. Each of these lines is depicting a set of studies that have been done that show that you can prevent problems later in life. And so prenatal care, home visiting, early childhood interventions. And I'm going to give you a brief sample of some of those. This is a summary of basically what we know. What we need to do is make sure that every kid has the cognitive skills, the language, numeracy, and executive function, which is sort of self-regulation skills, that they have the social competence to get along with others, that they don't have problems of a misbehavior and those depend, you know, which are all the things I've been talking about, and that they're physically healthy. You can pretty much characterize what they need as quality parenting, quality education, and a generally positive social environment. The thing I want to emphasize is that quality parenting, quality education are influenced by poverty and disorder in neighborhoods and the physical environment in neighborhoods. And so, and why are all those things important? Because they produce stress that increases family conflict, that increases the conflict and the difficulties in schools. And that seems to be the thing that leads to all of these different problems. If you follow out all these different problems and you track back to what was going on, it's coming out of kids who are trying to deal with very tense and difficult social environments. And so if we can make all of these environments more nurturing, we can prevent the entire range of problems. So here's somebody who's made parenting more nurturing. This is David Oles, and he developed the Nurse Family Partnership starting about 25 years ago at the University of Rochester. He set up a program where nurses visit pregnant women, high-risk pregnant women, during the pregnancy and work with them for the first 2 years of the baby's life. And they provide prenatal care, deal with maternal smoking, which is a huge risk factor for problems in kids, and work on mothering and contraception and work life. And what he found was that they significantly reduced not only child abuse and neglect, but they improved children's behavioral development, mother's economic well-being, time to the next baby, They even reduced arrest rates in adolescence of these kids. This is the Positive Parenting Program, Triple P, which is based on programs developed in Oregon, but it actually comes from Australia. A colleague of mine at the University of South Carolina took 18 counties in South Carolina and randomly assigned 9 of them to get Triple P, and the other 9 didn't get it. Triple P involves finding simple ways to reach parents of young children with information about parenting, the kind of education that Representative Maurer was talking about. What they found was that simple program reduced substantiated child maltreatment and the need to put kids in foster care. And what they did was they trained about 600 people in those 9 counties to just reach parents of young children and help them very often with very simple advice. So you don't necessarily need a complex program. This is Tom DeShawn from the University of Oregon Child and Family Center. He and his colleagues have developed the family checkup where a parent support person in middle schools works with parents of high-risk families, and they basically kind of do a family checkup, and it's a strength-based program where they identify the strengths of the family, and then they give them advice to strengthen their monitoring and limit setting, their positive reinforcement, and so on. He's shown in a study he did in Portland that you can significantly reduce arrest rates at 18 years old of kids who got this in 6th and 7th grade, and that you can significantly reduce substance use. And then there's the good behavior game. This is Shep Kellum, a psychiatrist who at the time was at Johns Hopkins University. The good behavior game goes like this. This is the blue team. This is the green team. If you are on task and cooperative during class for the next 20 minutes, then you get a reward. And both teams can win. And the reward might be something as simple as an extra 5 minutes of recess, or everybody gets to run around the room and yell for 2 minutes. What they found was that this program significantly reduced arrest rates. These are kids who got it in first grade. It significantly reduced arrest rates in 6th grade. They followed these folks into adulthood. There was less substance use, suicidality, and criminal behavior among the kids who got this just in first grade. If you create a nurturing environment that helps kids to develop the basic skills, social and academic skills they need, you put them on a course that's going to prevent all of these different problems. In the interest of time, I'm going to skip this. This is multidimensional treatment foster care program developed here in Oregon. Oregon is one of the leading places in the country for its research on prevention. This is a program that takes kids who have been adjudicated and puts them in foster care that's very carefully supervised. There's backup for the foster families 24/7, and they have shown that they can produce fewer arrests, reduce delinquency, and reduce crime. This is an analysis which is in the material I handed out of the cost benefits of these kinds of interventions. And the point is that these kinds of interventions save significant amounts of money in terms of health care costs and criminal justice costs and victims' costs. So I would reiterate that there are things that can be done all across the lifespan. And if we do them, we can prevent an enormous proportion of these problems. I also mentioned, because I've gotten involved in this in Lane County, I've been looking at the evidence-based rehabilitation of offenders. And this is a summary, and it's in your form, of things that are effective components of rehabilitation. I would argue that the states that make use of all this research evidence will have a better educated and more productive population, lower crime rates, less drug abuse and mental illness, less child abuse. And I would argue that, you know, as I said, Oregon is one of the leading places in the country. Most of I would say half of the studies, prevention studies that have been done here in Oregon. And I think it would be a sad irony if we didn't lead the rest of the nation in putting into practice all of these interventions. So one of the things that I think is needed is to that we need to be organized to ensure that cost-effective, evidence-based practices are being delivered to everyone who needs them. And I wouldn't argue that government can or should provide all of these preventive interventions. Prevention's a little difficult in the sense that it matters what a teacher does and what a preschool teacher does and what somebody, interacting with families. So it's a more complex. But I think that in addition to funding evidence-based practices, what the state of Oregon can do is exactly what you were talking about, which is to provide the education to inform people about what a difference we can make in the lives of children and the reduction of crime by providing these kinds of things. And so my hope is that everybody will start to get this and they will start to look at ways in which they can make schools more nurturing, homes more nurturing, workplaces more nurturing, and in the process prevent this entire range of problems. And if I've taken too long, I apologize.
You've taken just about right. And I know there are questions, but I know we have another presenter to present in about 15 minutes, if we can give you that. And then we'll come back to questions. But I think, Dr. Biglin, we'll have to have you back another time so you can talk in more detail about these issues. I have a great deal of interest, and I think others do on the committee. Thank you, and we'll come back if we have time for questions. Thank you for coming today.
Sure. Good morning, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. My name is Tim Hartnett. I'm the executive director of CODA, an alcohol and drug and mental health treatment agency in Portland. I'm also president of the Oregon Treatment and Prevention Providers Association. I, along with Max Williams, co-chair the treatment subcommittee. One of the sort of downsides of batting cleanup is you sit in the audience as discussion happens and you check off all the points that you were going to make. So I'm going to hop around a little bit or just really target two points that I think our commission has recognized will be meaningful challenges as we move forward. One is what I would call acute care versus chronic disease model. The second has to do with a larger integration of alcohol and drug services into communities, and also continuing our efforts to integrate alcohol and drug activity into the child welfare, correctional systems, and other social service and healthcare systems. For the most part, I've been involved in alcohol and drug treatment for nearly 30 years, and much of the care has been dictated by what I call the remove, repair, and return model, where we take people, remove them from their communities when things are desperate and, in effect, have reached an acute stage. We try and infuse them with skills and return them to their communities. And in effect, we wait for things to get really bad. When families have deteriorated substantially, divorce is imminent, detoxification is needed, that kind of thing. I think we've all come to appreciate that that although we've had good success or moderate success with that model, that we can do better. And currently, our commission and many in addictions now are really looking to disease management or chronic disease notions to guide how we organize services. In effect, what we've done is treat addictions like a broken leg. You go in, you get a cast put on it, you get your cast taken off, and you're supposed to be better. And we know from studies that addictions really mimic other chronic diseases like diabetes, asthma, and hypertension. They mimic them in that there's a genetic component. In other words, it's hereditary. There's also a kind of socialization aspect to addictions, and I can just use my own family when I think about hypertension. Many in my family suffer from hypertension, and since I can remember, at our breakfast, lunch, and dinner table, you loaded up on the salt, and then you tasted your meal. Mm-hmm. That's how I was socialized. So I think the same thing can be said of alcohol or drug use as well. The last part that we know makes it resemble chronic disease, that we know that people behave in a similar way to chronic disease, which is to say some people do well with earlier interventions. For example, when diabetes shows up, some people can learn to manage it with diet. Other people do not, and they require more intensive levels of care and require insulin. And yet other folks who struggle with diabetes simply won't get well. And we know that we need to create an addictions treatment system that reflects this chronic disease model. We can certainly look to the American Medical Association, the World Health Organization, the National Institutes of Health. All are supporting this idea of movement towards a chronic disease model. We know that we need to, in order to do that, we need to have aggressive prevention system that reflects chronic disease. I'll give you a small example of what I mean. Much of what we talk about with prevention really targets kids, quite understandably, but we need to look at prevention and prevention dosing across the life cycle. We know, for example, now that roughly 17% of seniors have a diagnosable alcohol or drug use disorder. And this happens in what we call late onset fashion, which is to say they haven't had what we would stereotypically understand as a life course of addictions. It set on in young adulthood, things got awful, et cetera, et cetera. These are folks who live perfectly functional and adaptive lives, but yet at the age of 65, 70, pick up an alcohol problem, pick up a drug dependence problem. And we don't really have a very aggressive prevention program. So to pile on a little bit about what's been said regarding prevention, we know that we need to have it through the course of the life cycle, and we know we need to dose it appropriately as we go through the life cycle. And that's part of what a chronic disease system would look like. We also know that we need to do a much better job at early identification and intervention. We do wait till things get awfully, awfully bad before we intervene. You've heard from other presenters about how we use the prison system as our intervention point. We need to be much more aggressive in high schools, colleges, and in primary care settings in identifying alcohol or drug problems. I'll just use myself as an example. I went to see my primary care doctor for a first visit 8 years ago. He didn't ask me a single thing about alcohol or drug use until I started lecturing him a little bit, and he didn't like it, and he found out what I did, and then he assumed I was in recovery, and then he started to ask me about it. And studies tell us that people will respond favorably to interventions with their primary care doc. People will respond to their primary care physician when asked about it. So this is a little bit about what a chronic disease model would look like. It also means that we need to use a much wider variety of resources. I know, Representative Maurer, you mentioned a little earlier the role of medication. There are a wide variety of medications now available to help people with addictions. There are a number that are under FDA study, but few of these medications make themselves into practice or into state Medicaid formularies, and we need to make those resources available to people. They're wonderful assets, and we're not taking advantage of them. But in other chronic diseases, gosh, we sure do, and they do a bang-up job. The other point that I wanted to raise with you has to do with integration. In my lifetime, when I think about large systems like child welfare and corrections, 30 years ago, we wouldn't acknowledge each other in the room. We thought we had nothing to do with one another. Over the last 20, 25 years, we've come to appreciate that we have a lot to do with each of our caseloads. But we still have a lot of work to do in sorting out the detail of what that relationship ought to look like, who ought to be doing what. And we need to broaden that net or broaden that integration into primary care and, lastly, into communities. What are we doing in boys and girls clubs? In communities to identify kids with alcohol and drug problems. What are we doing in communities to celebrate people who are in recovery, to make it possible for people who do struggle with alcohol and drug problems to step out of the stigma that they feel? And the best example I can give you of that that's happened in our lifetimes, that I hope will happen for people who struggle with alcohol and drug problems, is breast cancer. There's no shame or stigma attached to breast cancer, or very little today. And now we have an annual celebration and a walk where we applaud people who are supporting research and treatment for breast cancer. We applaud those who are survivors, and we do it in a very public and visible way. We need to bring that kind of enthusiasm into our communities for people who struggle with alcohol and drug problems. So I know we're pressed for time. I'll stop there with just one final comment. Having been a bureaucrat myself in another state, I do want to let you know, having been in this business for 30 years, it's very exciting to be a part of this commission and look at creating a potential platform where we can integrate our efforts and begin to work in a much more effective and cooperative way. If we can do that, I think this commission will have hit a home run.
Thank you, Mr. Hartnett. Thanks. I know you have a question. We'll open up questions for either of the two presenters. We still have 10 minutes.
Dr. Bigelin, I got a tenfold questions. I'd absolutely love to sit down and have a cup of coffee with you someday.
May I join you?
Madam Chair, it'd probably just be boy talk.
Yes.
Nice little presentation. I am curious with one of the slides that you had that dealt the problem behaviors development over time. How do you see other curricular activities playing into this, helping the direction and molding a child as they grow older, dealing with social skills?
In terms of curricula?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I didn't mention there are several. There's one developed by a guy named Mark Greenberg called the PADS program. And what they do in that is they teach kids, first of all, what they're about their emotions. And then they help them to figure out how they can deal with situations that evoke strong emotion. There's a version of this now that's available for preschoolers. And my wife runs a preschool for kids with developmental disabilities and typically developing kids. And what they have done since they implement that is, it used to be that if a kid got upset, you'd go, oh, okay, come on, we're going to the next activity. And now they stop and they get with the child and they talk about, oh, you're upset because he took your toy and so on. And it helps to calm them, but it also helps to teach them what their emotions are. Mm-hmm. And that's the first step in self-regulation, which seems to underpin so much of what happens. So there are good curricula there. In middle schools, there are curricula like life skills training, which teaches kids social skills and also skills for not getting involved in drugs. And that's been shown to prevent drug abuse even into adulthood. So there are some good programs for schools.
Yeah, thank you. I'll stop.
Thank you. And I want to ask you a question about the nurse-family partnership.
Yes.
So there's a similar program in Oregon that's not as intense as this program.
The Healthy Start.
Healthy Start. Thank you so much. Yes. So can you, do you have statistics on Healthy Start, how effective that is?
Well, I was on this IOM committee. And
IOM
Institute of Medicine in Washington, and I was doing the reviews of this stuff. And I became there was originally a Healthy Start evaluation in Hawaii, and it didn't turn out that it produced benefit. Oregon had already kind of committed to doing Healthy Start, but since then, there's been a study in the New York State that did show benefits to the Healthy Start program. One of the concerns that I have is that we be sure that we're doing what they did in New York State. Doing these, replicating these with fidelity is very important, and that's easily forgotten. But the other thing is that the nurse family partnership identifies at-risk women during their pregnancy. There's some evidence in the first study from the nurse family partnership
that it may have been simply getting women to stop smoking that accounted for the benefits of that program. There are studies like one done in Denmark by a colleague of mine where she found that when you controlled for everything else, if a mother was smoking, their kids were significantly more likely to be arrested as adolescents. Why did smoking have such an effect? Well, because babies are quitting smoking when they're born, and they are irritable, and they're difficult to calm. And if a mother isn't patient, they don't get off on the right track. And that seems to be why that develops. And so I think it's very important that we make sure that what we're doing in this state includes screening moms for whether or not they're smoking and doing an intervention. And in fact, there's a study actually done here in Oregon where if you simply pay moms to be free of nicotine each week for a series of weeks, you can help them to quit smoking. And it's highly cost effective because it's very expensive to have a baby that's born low birth weight.
Right, right. Thank you. Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. I would be remiss not to mention early Head Start and Head Start.
Yes.
But one of the interesting things that is occurring in Hood River right now is it's called Gutsy Girls. And it's started by a school counselor, and it's for 10-year-olds in the fifth grade. And it's building on self-esteem. And the reason I know about it is that they ran out of money, and so the local Soroptimist group raised $900 in 10 weeks. So it's a pretty inexpensive program. And so in looking at some of your criteria about early, I'm thinking that this might be a productive model for prevention. And so I was curious what you might think. I mean, I don't have enough details to give you much more than that, but...
As you were asking your question, I realized I've forgotten my manners. Representative Van Orman and Chairman Tomei. I think that kind of program is very useful. I'm always concerned that we have the best evidence for these programs. And one of the issues here is there's about $100 million a year that comes into Oregon in behavioral science research. We have a huge behavioral science industry. But it's not connected with the things that are being done by state government or local government. And so one of the things that I hope will come out of our commission are systems where we can connect researchers with a program like that and do further evaluation of it so that it refines it and so that we know that it's making a difference. This issue of accountability is, I think, very important. I think, and I see this in Lane County, where, as you may have heard, there is much tension about whether or not we're going to fund public safety. But I think citizens are distrustful that government can actually make a difference. They don't know about this kind of thing, you know, the kind of information I presented. If we can help them to understand that, and if we can show that when we implement a program, we're tracking to see that it actually made a difference, I think that over time, they will have more and more faith in what we're doing.
Thank you.
Representative Mauer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Real quickly, the Miller 2004 study that you cite in here, there's a Beglin associated with that.
There's a what?
There's a Beglin associated with that study. Is that you?
Probably.
Okay.
Okay. My son has published one paper, but yes.
Okay. The other question about that study is the cost, the difference in magnitude. I mean, smoking shouldn't even be listed as $5 million versus $2 billion for antisocial behavior. And I'm wondering if those figures are a little odd.
I'm glad, Representative Mauer, Chairman Tomei, I'm glad you asked that question. I argued with Ted Miller as he did that. He put the costs in that year of smoking. So if a kid was smoking that year, he was included those costs. He didn't include the costs, the long-term costs. If a kid is smoking, about a third of people who start smoking die of smoking-related illness. And the costs of smoking are huge, and he didn't include that. So you're right. If you add that in, there's a lot more cost.
My only pushback is I can show you some research that suggests that long-term costs are actually less because they do die earlier. It's kind of an oxymoronic position, but
I'm aware of the Philip Morris study.
I'll go with the moronic part.
That's a good way to end the meeting.
Thank you so much for coming. We really appreciate you coming down and giving us this information. We'd love to have you come back again.
Happy to.
And with that, I'm going to close the informational hearing on Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission. Thank you for coming. We'd love to have you come back again during the interim, please. And colleagues, we will be meeting at 8 o'clock. On Wednesday, we'll be hearing about relief nurseries, and if we have any bills coming from the Senate. And we'll start, did I say we'd start at 8?
Yes, you did, ma'am.
Okay, yes.
Yeah,
thank you. And anything for the good of the order?
No, Madam Chair, I just wanted to just to say that I think he hit the nail on the head on talking about the research institutes within Oregon, not the institute, right, but all of the research money that's coming into the state and connecting it with what we do here.
Right.
And because I can remember when I was at Portland State in the 70s, studies on pro-social behavior in psychology that we did. And
Right, exactly. Okay, with that, I'll close the House Committee on Human Services. Thank you all.